He tried every direction, but it had disappeared. For an entire day, he scooped at the dirt with his hands to discover if it was underground. How much easier it was to crawl than to stand and walk. And so he crawled, weeping, mouthing syllables. It rained, the dark gray clouds like unshaven jowls. His horizon was a sawtooth jag of black spruce. He caught a slow duckling, the last in a parade of ducklings on their way to water. He had found the river again. He thought he might be dying, but it seemed inconsequential. First he would get to the north, to the fur traders, then he would die. As he crept along the rediscovered river, he found small frogs and one more duckling that he caught and ate, cowering under the hammering beak and painful wing blows of the mother. Here the riverbank was soft mud, more comfortable for crawling. An Ottawa hunting party surrounded the creature. They had watched it for 2 days, inching around and around the margin of a small pond, sleeping in mud under the alders, then creeping again on hands and knees.
"He is sick," said one.
They all backed away.
"He is wounded," said another.
At the sound of their voices, Duquet reared up on his knees. He glowered at them out of his left eye. A pattern of alder twigs indented his cheek. He shaped his mud-crusted fingers into claws and hissed at them. He said something.
"He wishes to attack," said one.
The rest laughed, and their laughter enraged Duquet.
"He is a French," said one.
"We cannot take him. The French bring sickness."
"He is already sick. He cannot come among us."
"Leave him."
They backed away, disappeared. Days later, a party of French fur traders stopped at the Indians' riverside camp.
"We want peltries," said the old trader. "Look, for you we have axes, hatchets, needles. For you we have guns, bullets and powder."
The others displayed the goods in the bottom of their canoe.
"Oui, oui,"
said the middlemen hunters, bringing out beaver robes, well-worn and of best quality, collected in the north. They had few beaver, but many marten and lynx. Before the traders left, these Ottawa, laughing, mentioned the sick French crawling around and around the little pond. The traders discovered Duquet. The mud had dried, and to get at the man underneath, they had to crack and break it away. They carried him to the river and soaked him in the waters until he emerged from his clay armor. They doubted he would live, but the Indian woman with them took his case in hand. In treating him, she smelled the foul infection in his mouth. In her medicine bag, she had a small wood stick with a leather loop at the end. With this, she removed his rotting teeth, gave him an infection-fighting mouthwash and an opiate.
"Not die," she said.
The voyageurs put him in their worn canoe and set out for a distant Ojibwe village to the northwest. It was spring, the rivers almost clear of ice except in early morning, the warm afternoons fragrant and easy. A few mosquitoes flew around them slowly, legs dangling. In the Ojibwe village, where a stream flowed into a small lake, Duquet rested against a log and watched the Indians making canoes, a complex business that involved the whole encampment. The voyageurs made themselves useful, going with some of the younger men to gather the great sheets of birch bark, 20 feet long. As they brought them into camp, they laid them carefully in the stream to keep them supple and weighted them with stones. Some went into the swamp and felled white cedar trees they had girdled the year before, riving the seasoned wood lengthwise. The women went out every day to gather spruce roots and gum. They sat near Duquet, skinning the roots and halving them lengthwise. The Indians made 5 canoes for themselves and another 5 for the voyageurs while Duquet healed. He was up and walking stiffly, eating gargantuan meals of soft foods he could manage with his healing gums. His eyes cleared. His hearing improved, He felt his arms flood with strength, and when the new canoes were finished, the guide, an officious imbecile with a burn-scarred face, ordered him to take a seat with the milieu and paddle until he dropped. The fragile craft flew down the cold, boulder-studded rivers. There were days of burn and pain in his shoulder blades, wrists, and arms before his body accepted the tireless and rapid strokes, and every day he paddled longer. His neck, shoulders, arms began to swell with muscle. Always short in stature, he now took on the look of the voyageur, almost as wide at the shoulders as he was tall. He learned to read water, to understand currents, recognize eddies, whirlpools, to listen to the old hands whose expert knowledge of this violent, dangerous water world came from the bitterest kind of experience. In the evening, he told his story of being a poor boy from the Paris streets come to make his fortune in New France. A sinewy man with legs too long for the canoe, Forgeron, a Dutchman turned French by accident, a sailor and fisherman, a surveyor when he could get work, and an unhappy voyageur when he could not, spoke quietly to Duquet.
You are ignorant of the coureur du bois life. The woods runner's way is no road to wealth. We and the Indians do the dangerous work, and the company gets the money. We are all fools.
And in recent years, he went on, the fur trade had become unsettled and insecure. The coureur de bois no longer directly approached the trapper Indians to trade for furs. There were Indian specialists, middlemen, who arranged all that. Even now, those good Indians were being pushed out by enemy tribes and the decline in beaver numbers. As Duquet learned the intricacies and politics of the fur trade, he saw that what Forgeron said was true. Paddling in the milieu was no entry to wealth. The best that could come of it would be a short life of striving, of sleeping on riverbanks and looking up through the trees at a narrow slice of darkness, stinging with stars like cast handfuls of salt. Some of the men carried flintlock muzzle loaders, most the Charleville muskets used by the French army. But for Duquet, the loading procedure was impossibly slow. Without teeth, he could not bite off the end of the cartridge, but had to tear it open with his fingers. Instead, he took as his weapon the French tomahawk, practiced endlessly until he could cleave the tail off a flying bird, gather up the body, have it gutted and half-roasted, while a comrade was still loading his musket. Duquet hardened. He saw how the beaver quickly disappeared from hard-trapped areas, where the Indians took every animal, so intent were they on getting European tools and spirits, so harried were they by the acquisitive traders. The beaver country moved always farther north and west, yet there were white men who gained prodigiously. They were not penniless, runaway, indentured servants. Duquet set out now to get as much as he could from his lowly position in the fur trade and swore to watch for better opportunities. He had come to New France hoping for quick riches and a return to Old France, but now he wondered if his destiny was not linked to the vast land with its infinite forests and violent rivers. Was not this country his place in the world? Yes, and he would make something of value of it. He went through a rare hour of introspection, seeing that his nature chilled other men. He consciously began to act as a smiling, open fellow of winning address, who always had a good story and who, in the tavern, treated with a generous hand. He was sharpening his claws, and in his private center, he was an opportunistic tiger. If he had to tear and maul his way to wealth, he would do so. He began to barter privately for furs, offering a drink or two of cheap rum to the naive red men, hiding his activities from the others, sometimes cashing the furs and returning later to pick them up. He bargained ruthlessly with the Indians, smiling guilelessly into the savage faces as he accepted their heavy bundles of furs for a yard of cheap cloth and a cup of adulterated whiskey, a monstrous profit. Within the year, he was sick of the traders who had rescued him.
"Forgeron," he said one day as they struggled up a portage trail, "I do not enjoy these persons, especially the guide. I intend to look for another opportunity. Will you come as well?"
"Why not?" said Forgeron. "One canoe is very like another. The guide is difficult, perhaps because of his terrible history. The Iroquois threw him into a fire to roast."
"Then why did they not finish the cooking and eat him?"
"Perhaps you will have the chance to ask them that one day."
They worked in harmony, although Forgeron attracted storms and wind. But he had a certain regard for the wild woods. He spoke often to Duquet of the forest and its great untapped wealth.
"If a man could get the logs out, there are 100,000 fortunes all around us, the like of which the world has not seen since the days of Babylon. It is entirely a question of moving the wood to those who need it."
Duquet nodded and began to look at trees with a more acquisitive eye. They fell in with a flamboyant company of coureurs de bois, among whom were the easygoing Trépanier brothers, so unlike the high-minded seigneur. They had a reckless style and could out-howl wolves. Duquet needed every paddling skill he had learned for some of the wild water they ran, between rock ledges that squeezed the canoe through violent chutes, and, in one extraordinary place, between two towering cliffs that leaned toward each other, narrower than the river, so that the sky was a rock-edged slice. When they emerged from the pinching canyon, the river hurled itself into a maelstrom. It was necessary to leave the water and edge upward along the Indian trail, little more than a foot width of slippery rock, somehow carrying the canoe over their heads, its weight making their arms quiver. At last they gained the cliff top and could look down on the thrashing water below.
"Tabernacle," said Toussaint Trépanier. "I pressed against the cliff face so passionately, I left the imprint of my manhood on it."
They carried their canoes for many miles that day. One night, lying under an overturned canoe, Forgeron murmured that he intended to leave.
"My legs are no good for the canoe," he said.
It was true that his long arms worked the paddle with great power, but his legs were folded and doubled under him for many hours, and when he left the canoe, he often had trouble standing upright, so cramped and tightened were his muscles. Many nights he lay groaning from the pain and rubbing his thighs and calves. Voyageurs were short-legged and strong-armed. Long legs did not belong in a canoe. When he finally left, saying he would look for surveying work, Duquet left with him, persuading the Trépanyers to come along. They headed back toward the Saint Laurent. Within a month, Forgeron found work laying out property lines east of Ville-Marie.
"Our paths will cross again," said Forgeron, "but not in a canoe."
Duquet continued gathering furs with the Trépanier brothers, and they became an infamous trio, pouring rum and whiskey for the Indians, red men who gave away their furs in return for terrible and vision-invoking spirits. 9. Les Quatrains de Pibrac. Guy de Fort, Seigneur de Pibrac. He prospered during the seasons following a bad year when the settlements were sick with longing for overdue supply ships from France, sick with fear of the Iroquois, who had only 10 years earlier surprised and slaughtered the inhabitants of Lachine, and might do so again. In spite of ongoing fighting, huge loads of beaver pelts came down the river and kept coming until the hatters and furriers of France could use no more, until the warehouses were packed full of rodent fur. Again, Duquet saw the great weakness of the trade, surplus or scarcity. Beaver might disappear from overtrapping or disease or for no discernible reason, or the Indians took too many. He watched and considered. He now regarded tales of immense profits in the fur trade as fables. He wanted great and permanent wealth, wealth for 100 years. He wanted a fortune to pass on to his sons. He wanted his name on buildings. He was surprised to discover in himself a wish for children, a wish to establish a family name. The name Duquet would change from a curse to an honor. But there were difficulties, especially the ugliness of a toothless, collapsed jaw. It might be impossible to find a handsome wife, unless he had money. His agile mind ceaselessly worked over the question, what resource existed in this new world that was limitless, that had value, that could build a fortune? He rejected living creatures such as beaver, fish, seals, game, or birds, all subject to sudden disappearance and fickle markets. He repeatedly came back to the same conclusion. There was one everlasting commodity that Europe lacked: the forest. Duquet knew, as everyone knew, that the English colonists to the south did well cutting pines for English navy masts. Could the French not do the same? He remembered Forgeron's talk. The forest was unimaginably vast, and it replaced itself. It could supply timber and wood for ships, houses, warmth. The profits could come forever. Yes, there were many problems of transport and markets, but it was an unexploited business that could expand and dominate. In France, there were men who dealt in forest goods, but few in New France, and perhaps not in the colonies to the south. So, he thought, he would get as much money as he could with the furs in the next few years, prepare himself in every way, and then change to timber when he was ready. He would not yet give up the lucrative fur trade, a stinking, complicated business for trapper Indians, but with high profits for white traders with market connections. He briefly sketched his plan to the Trépanier brothers and told them he would be glad if they continued with him as partners when he made his future move to timber and wood. He was surprised that they were not enthusiastic. Their eyes reflected the evening fire like orange beetles. Perhaps, Toussaint said, and Fernand said they would see. They looked away into the trees.
Well, let it stay as it is.
Duquet passed on to another subject and said there was one great obstacle he had to overcome. He could neither read nor write, and it was necessary to gain those skills if he were not to be cheated in dealings with sly merchants. He did not know even a single letter, such as that fool Sell had doted on.
"The world cheats men who cannot read. I know this, as I have often seen it," Toussaint said. "If you wish to do this, you need one of the black robes. The Jesuits all can write countless pages, all can read both silently and aloud until their eyes cross. Let us get one of these fellows and carry him with us. He can convert Indians while we bargain, and in quiet moments he will teach you those arts you wish to acquire."
And so they kidnapped Père Naufragé, one of several missionaries on the way to the Hurons. For several days they watched the little group and their Huron guides before acting.
"See,"
whispered Toussaint from behind their tree.
"There are four of them. Choose the one you like. We'll get him when he steps aside to answer the call of nature."
Duquet studied each of the fathers. One seemed quicker and more sprightly than the others. He was first to rise, made the fire with the high technology of a burning glass if the sun shone, packed and unpacked their goods with alacrity, and spent the least time in prayers. When the missionary stepped into the shadows and hiked up his robe to relieve himself, they sprang like savages. Toussaint clapped a leather gag over the priest's mouth. Fernand bound his hands behind him, and Duquet frog-marched him into the forest and away to their camp.
"You are French!"
exclaimed the priest later when Duquet pulled off the gag.
"I thought you were Indians. Why have you taken me from my brothers? We are traveling to the Hurons."
Duquet explained that the Hurons could wait. Père Naufragé would stay with them until Duquet learned to read and write. The Jesuit would be treated well, and was advised not to try to escape.
"For if the Iroquois get you, you will become a martyr."
Père Naufragé said he was eager to become a martyr,
more eager than to teach illiterates the rudiments of the alphabet.
My friends expect me. I warn you, you will pay dearly for this outrage.
Duquet described the ample opportunities the Jesuit would have to convert savages as they traveled about the country, gathering furs.
What you ask is not even possible. My books of instruction are with my traveling companions.
The Jesuit smiled triumphantly.
That is no problem, said Fernand,
opening his possibles bag and rummaging to the bottom. With a vengeful smile, he pulled out a stained, worn book and thrust it at Père Naufragé.
Ici, here is your instruction book, Les Quatrains de Pibrac. It was a gift from my mother, and I have never been parted from it. First, honor God, then father and mother. Dieu tout premier, puis père et mère honoré, he quoted. Everything in the world can be found in the pages of Pibrac.
God knows you will do more good with us than with 1,000 Hurons.
Père Naufragé, habituated to obedience, nodded acceptance, but insisted on daily devotions, a weekly mass, and time set aside for disputation on a theological subject which he would select. The priest had a face like a short sword, thin and sharp. His olive skin stretched over jutting cheekbones, and his crenellated hair was as black as that of any Spaniard. Ah, thought Duquet, the fellow looks like a Moor. But it was when he smiled, which he did not do until the third day after his capture, that his face changed entirely. His mouth was very wide, and his face seemed to separate into two unrelated parts. And his pointed teeth,
Mon Dieu,
thought Duquet, muttering under his breath,
how many is there?
Dazzled with an unnatural whiteness. As for the lessons, Duquet learned quickly. He scrawled his letters and numbers, arithmetic quickly becoming part of the curriculum, on hundreds of pieces of birch bark. His hands, heavily muscled by years of paddling, labored with the small muscle coordination necessary to form elegant letters, and his handwriting was coarse. No matter, it was legible. The priest became embedded in the little group and closed his eyes to the whiskey trades and his pupil's disturbing aura of ambitious greed. He was fascinated by Duquet's grasp of information, for he seemed to remember everything, scraps of German, Greek, Latin, and English, all that the priest uttered, even prayers. At the end of the first year, Pibrac retired to Fernand's bag again as he was suffering wear, but Duquet had memorized the contents and had quatrains to cover every situation in life, should he care to quote doggerel. But he preferred to despise Pibrac. In early spring, 2 years later, Père Naufragé, dressed now like a woodsman as his cassock had shredded in the brush, left them unwillingly.
But it is time for you to go, said Duquet with a patient smile. As Pibrac says, the steps of man are directed by God. We will take you now to the Hurons, as I must travel to France on business.
Another year of study, and I believe you could have acquired a considerable handiness with Latin, the most important language for men of business, such as you intend to become.
But Duquet only twitched his mouth. His thoughts ran in a different direction. 6 days of travel, skirting burning fields and woods, brought them to the edge of the forest around the Huron mission. Fernand, coughing, said,
Every time I have been in the Huron country, the place is afire.
Duquet stood aside while the Trépanese embraced the priest and wished him good fortune. They watched him make his way toward the clearing. Then he disappeared into the smoke. 10. All the world wishes to go to China. Duquet could not keep his mind on furs. Again and again he considered the dense problems of the timber trade. First, the trees. The best ones did not always grow near river landings. And who would buy the raw logs when every man could cut what he needed? But sawn planks, ready to carpenter. That was the way.
A water-powered sawmill or a saw pit with tools and men was a primary necessity. He began to note objects made of wood. Everything in the world. And it was all around him in quantities inexhaustible and prime. Could the Royal French Navy be persuaded to buy New France timber? England, he knew, badly wanted naval stores as the endless war had disrupted their heavy Baltic trade. Although England was the enemy, there were great benefits in trading with them, perhaps possible through a third party. And what of Spain and Portugal? His mind began to weigh the possibilities. He talked to himself as the Trépanese did not care for the subject.
Which trees are the most desirable? Oak, of course, but oak is scattered and seems to grow only in certain places. Why it is not widespread as pine and spruce, I do not know.
Could English shipbuilders use pine? Hemlock? Beech? How could he move the desirable mast trees from the forest to a ship? Indeed, he needed a ship and a captain if he was to deliver wood products to a land as distant as France. Thinking of uncommon woods sent his thoughts back to the fur trade, his immediate calling. Why should he concentrate on beaver as everyone else did? There must be those who desired other furs as mink, ermine, otter, muskrat, fox, spotted lynx, and marten. He decided to take a season gathering such luxury furs, then go to France with a shipload of rare pelts. He began at once, harrying the Indians for every kind of fur, acting as his own middleman. Sitting at the campfire, drinking the harsh whiskey intended for the Indians, fiery with piquin peppers from the Carib to prove its strength, on his last evening with the Trépanese, he declared that while he was in France, he would find himself a wife and set her to work bearing children. The Trépanis brothers, in their farewell debauch, said jokingly, while he was at it, to bring back women for them. Duquet took passage on a ship bound for France, commanded by Captain Honoré Déon, a gray and weathered man with a syphilitic canker on his upper lip. When the captain invited him to dine, Duquet used the opportunity to ask how he might find passage on a China-bound ship.
"I know European ships go there," he said.
Captain Déon brushed the canker with the knuckle of his right index finger and sighed heavily.
"All the world wants to go to China," he said. "They say, sir, that it is an immensely rich country with many interesting and beautiful objects. On their return, one may stop in the islands and purchase the best coffee. And it is known the profits from tea and silks are enormous, and coffee as well, I dare say. But it is not so easy to trade in China. For permission, one must be part of an official delegation, as well as prepare great gifts for the emperor and the many officials. This gift, and many others, they take as their just due. And they are not much interested in Western goods, only silver. They say they have everything they need or want in their own country. I have no idea what your goods are, but a lone merchant, if you are such, sir, really cannot do business there. It is too difficult."
"My business is fine furs, but even if I cannot get there," said Duquet, "how is it others reach China? Who does trade there? Who sends ships to China?"
"The Portuguese were first. Now the Dutch, England, and even France. All are trying to work the eastern trade. But the Dutch are the ones who go there regularly. The Vereenigde Oost-Indische Company, the Dutch East India Company, largest business in the world, controls everything. Perhaps you can find a sympathetic captain who will take you aboard. And I have heard there are a few independent captain traders who are not tied to the VOC. Those are the men you should seek out, but I know none of them."
He swallowed his tumbler of rum and delicately touched the sore on his lip with the long nail of his little finger.
"And," he said, "I doubt you speak Chinese."
Very little, said Duquet.
He would learn the most important words as soon as he heard them. In La Rochelle, unpleasant feelings came over Duquet. The old smells of poverty nearly sent him bending and creeping along close to the walls as he had done in childhood. Relentless hunger and chilblains had been his childhood lot. Of his father, he remembered beatings and curses, and at the last, a pair of receding legs. His eyes burned from the smoke of greasy street fires, and he thought of the clear rivers of Quebec, of the forest air, and with these cleansing memories he regained himself. Yet he was mortified that his clothes and person announced him as a country bumpkin in French streets. In New France, he and the Trépanier brothers had been skillful with war hatchets, but he saw no hatchets on the street of La Rochelle. He went to the armorer's and purchased a Walloon sword, ambidextrous, flexible. He saw many of these on the street. It was a gentleman's sword. One day, he swore silently, he would order fine garments and a full, rich wig. In the area between Rue de Petit Bac and Rue des Amoureux, where the merchants congregated daily, he talked with a sallow wool merchant whose greasy hands trembled. When Duquet casually mentioned China, the merchant said his cousin had been a sailor pressed into 3 years' service on a Dutch voyage from Hoorn to Guangzhou, that the English called Canton.
He said it was a very long journey to a horrible place,
and the merchant passed back Duquet's brandy bottle.
Very strong stink. Food? Affreux. Foreigners not allowed in the city, but penned up in a horrible foreigner's quarter. He prayed to return home, and they despised the ship's cargo, which was horses, the captain having heard the Chinese longed for them horribly. But in Canton, the go-between merchant said China now had secured its own horses from the north, so the trip was for nothing. And on the return journey, the captain was so angry, he pushed all those horrible, worthless horses into the sea. They could see them swimming after the ship for a long time.
Oh, horrible, said Duquet,
at once planning to make his way to Amsterdam or Hoorn. How many times had Forgeron told him the men of the Low Countries had a talent for business?
Stay away from the East India Company ships. They are bound by hard rules, and the captains take blood oaths to uphold them. It is a horrible, grasping company that allowed no competition for many years. Only East India ships were allowed to traverse the horrible Strait of Magellan. Now the Cape Horn route has been discovered, their grasp is broken. But the old animosities linger. You must choose a captain with care.
XI. Dutch Sea Captain. Without exception, every ship captain he approached was exceedingly suspicious, for trade routes and overseas contacts were under constant threat by spies, and Duquet was immediately and repeatedly identified as a French spy. Only after detailed descriptions of the forests of Quebec and the rigors of the fur trade, as well as a flash of the marten skin he had begun to carry as proof of his identity, could he prove his disinterested innocence in matters of trade route secrets. In the Rock and Shoal, a sailor's tavern on the waterfront, he noticed a group of convivial men who seemed all to be captain mariners. They spoke in a mixture of languages, mostly German, French, Portuguese, Flemish, and Dutch, and seemed to be placing bets. One, whom he heard called Captain Verdwijnen, a fair-faced man with a large nose and scarred cheek, wheaten wisps of unshorn hair sticking out from the edges of his ill-seated wig, particularly caught his eye because of his ceaseless motions and apparent sanguine temperament. Duquet edged closer to the group until he was nearly among them, grasping at half-understood words in the babble of discourse. After a long time, Verdwijnen made his excuses to the company and said he had to get back to his ship. Duquet followed him out into the dark street. The captain suddenly spun around and flashed a dagger at Duquet. Footpad! He shouted into the night. Help! Robbery! Assault! Murder!
Captain Verdwijnen, said Duquet, I am no footpad. I am a friend. I am a fur merchant from New France, begging your favor.
And he bowed low, making a clumsy leg. He presented himself as an enterprising businessman. He became the sweet-voiced, persuasive Duquet, talked on, explaining and mollifying, opening his pack of furs, which he carried on his back like a peddler. He said that he could pay for his passage. He had enjoyed a good sale of his furs in Montreal, keeping out the best to trade in the East. Moreover, he would supply the captain with the cases of the best Schiedam Jenever for the voyage, the special distillation of gin with a green label showing a large yellow eye, the eye of a furious lion, far superior to the slop the captain had swallowed in the Rock and Shoal. Look, he had a bottle in his coat pocket this very minute, and he swung the garment open to show the luteous eye. The Dutchman thawed a little and told Duquet to follow him aboard his ship, Steen Arendt, the Golden Eagle, where they could speak more comfortably. Duquet was surprised to see it was an armed, full-rigged, three-masted frigate, which could accommodate more than 100 men, the gunroom painted red to hide bloodstains.
There are many pirates in the South China Sea, explained Captain Verdwijnen.
Duquet had seen him drink countless glasses of Jenever in the sailor's tavern, but the man spoke with clarity and decisiveness. The captain said he was indeed suspicious of foreigners, especially the French and English, most of whom were spies, and it could cost him his livelihood to take Duquet aboard if the ship's German owner heard of it, and of course he would hear of it. He glared at Duquet and clenched his fists.
What you are asking me to do is a grave thing. I cannot do it. Why, sir, it is a thing that was never done before, and never should be done. Knew it. Never.
He wrenched his face through an extraordinary series of grimaces and frowns. Duquet spoke humbly.
I am only interested in securing a market for my furs, and I am most sensible, dear captain, of the honor you do me by even discussing such a matter.
His mouth curved. His eyes winked. He smiled, opened his coat, and took out the bottle, uncorked it, and handed it to the captain.
Perhaps we can discuss it further, he said softly, if you do not hold me to be completely odious.
He had marked the captain as one who would do much for a little cup of spirits, not unlike the Indians of the North. The captain's cabin was a great room, the rear windows giving a vertiginous view of the port. There was a single chair before a mahogany table covered with charts. The captain waved Duquet to a small side bench bolted to the floor. Under it lay a huge mastiff that growled at Duquet. The captain sat in his chair, now holding a glass brimming with that best Jenever. He nodded at the glass.
Good. We Dutch must drink or die, you know.
He swallowed.
Or so they say.
Duquet opened his pack and laid several of the furs atop the charts. The dog looked at the furs with interest.
Of course, I am always happy to buy furs myself to take to Amsterdam, the captain said.
I shall keep that in mind, but my information is that I can get a great deal of money for them in China, and I wish to establish a trading connection in that place.
Captain Outre Verdwijnen squinted his eyes. Duquet might understand more about business than he showed. Or indeed, Duquet might be a spy, evil thought. But after an hour of serious drinking, when the captain knew Duquet a little better, he abandoned the spy characterization, and when he learned his guest would send 10 cases of the green and gold labeled bottles aboard, he told Duquet he might make the journey.
We sail in 2 weeks. It is already April. Late in the season to begin this voyage. We must catch the southwest monsoon winds that carry ships to India and China between June and September. So, make ready and be here on the appointed day. I will show you your quarters, which you will share with Mynheer Choppend, he said.
and he led Duquet to a pitifully small and rank cubby, though there was a scuttle. His bunk was a wide plank. The other contained a roll of gray blankets and a great leathern bag. On the floor, as though tossed there, were sea boots and heavy gloves, and that constituted Meinherr Toppunt's presence. Ashore the next day, Duquet ordered 3 dozen cases of the green-label gin delivered to the ship. At the ship chandler's shop, he outfitted himself with a hammock, rough, sturdy clothes, and an oiled cape sworn to keep rain out, a bound ledger, quills and ink, and an expensive spyglass and a bag of brown sugar. A week before they sailed, Captain Verdwijnen hailed him. "Monsieur Duquet," he said, "I'm going to the coffee house to arrange my insurance. As you propose to get into business, perhaps you would like to accompany me for the valuable contacts." Certainly Duquet would. What a stroke of fortune. They walked for 20 minutes before they reached the coffee house and entered a large room where men sat at tables with papers and account books in front of them. Some scribbled furiously, others talked, pushing their faces forward. At the back of the room, 5 bewigged men laughed as a 6th read from a letter. Near the front, a woman handed bowls of hot beverage to serving boys, and Captain Verdwijnen called out for 2 coffees, 2 cafés, and led Duquet to the back table of laughing men, the marine insurance brokers. As they approached, the laughing faded away, and 6 serious and attentive faces turned toward them.
"Ah, Captain Verdwijnen, here to arrange your insurance, no doubt. Would this gentleman with you be the ship owner?"
Captain Verdwijnen's laugh was a bray.
"No, no, he is not the owner of the ship. He is Monsieur Duquet, a gentleman from New France in the timber export business. At the moment he is carrying furs. I thought he might like to meet you gentlemen for future consultations."
The serving boy brought the coffee. Duquet looked suspiciously at the sinister black liquid. It was scalding and bitter, a very dreadful potion, but he drank it. In a quarter of an hour, he felt ideas rushing into his head. He memorized the faces before him with newly sharpened senses. As he looked around, he saw a man of about 35 with a face that seemed made of some flesh-like material that, once formed, remained set and immobile. A pair of little obsidian eyes looked out at the world as if measuring an antagonist. The unsmiling mouth was pinched and suggested meanness. The ringed fingers and flamboyant crimson sleeves did little to soften the impression of suspicious calculation. The man's gaze rose from the black sums he was making and fixed on Duquet. The space between them quivered with a discharge of mutual antipathy.
"Who is that man?" Duquet murmured to the captain, letting the words slip out quietly.
"He is a Lübeck trader in wax and metal ores, I believe, here and in Bruges. How he does stare! It's as if he knows you."
"He does not know me, nor will he ever know me," said Duquet.
But the man's stiff look indicated that he was familiar with the likes of Duquet through and through. It was the stare of a predator encountering another of its kind, nosing about in its territory.
12. Stein Arendt. The ship's crew was polyglot. Spanish, French, Flemish, Greek, German, Genoese, young men from the Malay, from the Canaries, the Isle of Dogs. Duquet thought they looked dangerous, very unlike the rough-cut, good-natured voyageurs he had known in New France. Captain Outher Verdwijnen served as his own master, and in this time of dead reckoning and anxious guesswork on the exact location of one's ship, had a reputation for accurate navigation, which Duquet thought might be related to the man's constant study and annotation of charts. But the captain said the charts told nothing of a ship's ever-changing longitudinal position, the bête noire of international trade. But he could recognize the warm black Kuroshio current, and was often within 40 miles of the desired port, by which margin men generally considered him an expert navigator. The captain's bonhomie evaporated the instant he stepped aboard the Steyn Arendt, though he continued his cordiality with Duquet over a glass of the yellow-eyed Genever in the evenings. His conversation was lively, of ships and their cargoes, of their short lives and the myth of 100-year-old ships, of pirates, and great storms at sea. He described the Sunda Strait as treacherous, the equatorial doldrums as maddening, the Guinea current as a trap, and getting caught in the southeasterly trade winds as the sure failure of a voyage. As they sailed out into the quilted ocean, Duquet noticed three or four ships were always in sight. When he remarked on it, Captain Verdvinen said knowingly, "My friends, Vrienden," smiled and shrugged. The ship stank fearfully, though Captain Verdvinen was proud of the pistails and the officers' closeted seats of ease with their drains into the sea. The crew perched on an open row of hold seats in the beak, cursing when the icy waves rinsed their salt-raw backsides. "For we learned from the Portuguese that this is the way to avoid what they call bicho de cu, a painful anal infection so burning and biting that seamen went mad with the agony in the olden times," said the captain. To Duquet, the officers looked a rather seedy lot in comparison with the younger crew, though when he made the remark, Captain Verdvinen laughed and said appearances were deceiving, that while most of the crew looked strong, they were riddled with venereal diseases, were laced through with insanities, and as stupid as penguins. The officers, on the other hand, were not an attractive lot, but each was skilled and experienced in a useful way. Duquet's cabin mate, François Toppent, was a pockmarked man whose narrow arms and fleshless face gave him a look of weakness, dispelled by his agility. He dressed smartly in contrast with the crew in their tarry red-nap trousers, cut high and wide, and the caps they knitted themselves. He was as limber as a dancing master, with a knack for making lightning decisions. He thought he had been born in Bourgogne and brought as a young boy to Amsterdam. When his parents both died of the plague, he had been adopted by watchmaker Willem Toppent and his childless wife. There were similarities between the two men. They both moved at high speeds in body and mind, both were pleased to be able to converse in French, although Toppent's use of the language was crippled by long neglect and interlarded with Dutch words and phrases. He was also a devotee of the sailor's great pastime, collecting rarities of the natural world. He told Duquet that in his home cabinet of curiosities he had a set of spider teeth and a stuffed bird of paradise, the strange Vogel, born without feet. Then he told Duquet that the captain's mastiff enjoyed climbing into the rigging where he would bark a warning at the sight of pirates. A few days after he came on board, Duquet confided to François Toppent that he wanted to order new clothing and a wig that would be ready when they returned from China.
"You will have to pay in advance," said Toppent, "but I know a good tailor in Paris, and there are wig makers in the same street. There are yet 5 days before we sail. Let us persuade the captain for leave, take a coach to Paris, and visit these worthies, for I, too, would like a wig for special occasions."
The jolting coach nearly liquefied their livers, and Duquet chose to get out and run alongside the equipage at every chance. In Paris, they found an inn near the street of wigmakers and tailors. The next sunrise brought one of those blue and spicy days when the wind cleared away noisome odors. It was a fine day for walking, and Duquet and Toppent strode through the streets. Toppent pointed out a popular coffee shop. They went in, and Duquet decided to risk the coffee again. Toppent smacked his lips over the sugared chocolate and declared it delicious. Despite the tarry flavor of the coffee, Duquet once again felt charged with energy and sharp-minded. Toppent said that was one of the many virtues of the dark fluid.
"It is good for ailments as well," said the gray-headed coffee-house server, joining their conversation. "It is the favored drink of merchants and businessmen, as it allows them to do great sums in their heads and to work long hours."
At the tailor's shop, Duquet selected blue velvet for his coat and accepted the idea of a pair of culottes cut on the bias. The obsequious tailor suggested a fine English cloth, remarking that this fabric was very much preferred. But Duquet chose a striped blue satin, though he couldn't resist the man's suggestion to visit the bootmaker next door for a pair of the delicate shoes with rounded toes just coming into vogue. The wig maker, his hands shaking with some ague-like affliction or a surfeit of coffee, urged the latest style, smaller, flatter on top, and with pigeon wings rippling back over the temples, instead of the full-bottomed wigs both men wanted. He stressed greater comfort and ease. Toppent said yes, but Duquet, his ideas of what a wealthy man looked like set, insisted on the great wig with its expensive mass of curls and frizz.
"Ready when you return, my dear, dear sirs, but only," said the man, "if you pay now, as shipwrecks, pirates, plague, and scurvy are not unknown among those who travel to the far eastern lands. If you perish, your survivors may call for the heir."
They endured an even more unpleasant journey back to La Rochelle. One of the coach horses fell dead in the traces, and then the axle broke on a rough detour. They hired saddle horses and rode more comfortably, but reached the ship with only hours to spare before she sailed. Captain Verdwijnen was in a foul temper and accused Toppent of neglecting his duty.
"That will be a black mark against you, sir," he said. "You will hear the result of my displeasure shortly."
What Toppent's punishment was, Duquet did not know, but he noticed the captain constantly found fault with all the mate did. So the ship departed, down the channel, past Brest, past Portugal, then west, well out to sea to avoid Africa's bulge and the doldrums, down, down through a zone of variable winds, until Captain Verdwijnen claimed he could smell Brazil, then swinging southeast for the Cape of Good Hope, keeping well away from the Agulhas current, and on, ever eastward, until they picked up the southwest monsoon in season that would carry them to the treacherous Sunda Strait and on to China. Duquet had no love for the sea. Rivers were the thing, ever-changing muscular waterways that challenged one to decipher their linear characters. In comparison, the ocean was a tiresome medium of waves that broke and swelled, sometimes lost their shapes and separated into confusion. Storms and throbbing rollers he endured, and hoped never to see a towering rogue wave as the sailors described, never to hear the awful moaning of a cyclone wind. Captain Verdwijnen kept a Spartan table and dined alone in his cabin on boiled pork, beer, bread, and cheese. At the officer's table, often augmented with fresh-caught dolphin or octopus soup, the dinner talk was conducted in a variety of languages, and pointing at the bread or wine was more useful than asking for it. Duquet could understand how Captain Verdwijnen had come to wave his arms and twitch his face in universal sign language. The cook, Li Wen, was Chinese, on his way back to China, said Captain Verdwijnen, after years of study in Amsterdam.
"What did he study?"
asked Duquet, suddenly interested.
"Dutch medicine, I believe. He is somewhat important in China, but frugal enough to work his passage by acting as cook." "So he is a physician?" "For this voyage, he is a surgeon, a master of head injuries, and he is the cook."
"But beyond the voyage, is he a physician in China?"
"He is a coroner."
"What is that, a coroner?"
"It is a skilled man who understands the signs of death, and who examines bodies to say if they have been the victims of foul play or natural causes. I would rather have him attend me than most ship's doctors, a group given over to drink and devious actions. Coroner is an important profession in China, where jealousies and rivalries are the equal of any at the French court, and one may purchase venoms at numerous shops."
Duquet cornered the coroner and said in his broken Dutch that he would like to learn at least a few phrases of the Chinese language. He showed a coin, but Li Wen looked horrified. He expostulated in fluent French.
Not possible. Chinese government not allow foreigners learn Chinese. Forbidden.
Li Wen then recited Chinese poems, translated and explained them to Duque. There was, he said, no law against declaiming Chinese poetry. Duque immediately saw himself as the powerful animal in Zhang Ji's poem of a tiger prowling mountain forests, so frightful that an entire village stood rigid, staring at the sight of his tracks. So too, Duque thought, he would claim whole forests. One evening, over their postprandial glass, Captain Verdvinen looked slyly at Duque and told him that in Guangzhou, Canton, he could order a set of ivory teeth to be carved that would fit his jaws and give him the appearance of a handsome rogue. The work could be done by the very same carver who fashioned dildos for sailors' wives. The carver, he said, was expensive, but worth it. And raising his hands as if in discovery, he said the Hong businessman who acted as his assigned merchant could arrange this and would likely be interested in Duque's furs. He stroked an especially fine lynx pelt that Duque had brought into his quarters.
This was intended as a gift to the Emperor of China, but I give it to you.
Duque pressed it into Captain Verdvinen's hands, adding that perhaps his wife would like it as company for the ivory implement.
Ha ha! Said Captain Verdvinen, uncorking another Yenever bottle with his teeth. Just as well. No foreigner has ever gained an audience with the Emperor of China.
It was late October when they and the ships that had kept them company entered the China Sea. The weather had been unusually fine down the west coast of Africa, but then the monsoon winds became dying and fitful. They stopped briefly at the Cape of Good Hope, but did not linger, as the VOC had a station there with men watching out for independent entrepreneurs. The wind was increasingly unreliable on the east coast. 4 stormy days, the sky shuddering, the sea choking on itself, impressed Duque as very violent, but he was alone in that opinion. 2 threatening sails came over the horizon. Captain Verdvinen said they were pirates, for through the spyglass he could make out their sinister flags. Duque asked innocently when the pirate warning mastiff would climb into the rigging, and only caught on when he heard the crew's smothered laughter. Listening to the table talk, Duque conjured up a picture of the oceans of the world dotted with ships suspended somehow in fog loom, all unconscious that other ships were near. Those ships carried cargoes of everything in the world.
What might be the principal cargoes? Asked Duque one evening at table.
The men began to name goods they had known on ships. At first they spoke grudgingly, but a spirit of competition took them, and they began excitedly interrupting each other.
Baskets of truffles, camel wool, bolts of yew, gunpowder, parrots, Potosi silver, yes, silver mined by dying men, tobacco, musk, ochre and indigo, Brazil nuts, do not forget madder, paper, pepper, cinnamon, all noble spices, calicoes, cotton, dyed silks, Brabant cloth, Biscay hatchets, pinones from monkey puzzle trees, horses and elephants, coral teething rings, lacquer, wool, fleeces, woven linen, cowrie shells for slave buying, pounded bark, bales of goat's hair, barrels of Shiraz, oxen, musical instruments, medical instruments, Arab scissors, jewels, shot cannon and precious metals, grain, maize and rice, ivory dominoes, salt, tea, Turkish shoes with curled toes.
Many of the men had served on VOC ships in earlier years, and as memories of old cargoes floated up, so did recollections of outstanding traders. The crew said ship's surgeons were especially canny traders.
Was a Good Hope or Batavia? The healthiest ones made their profits.
There is everything in the world if you only know where to find it and how to get it, said Toppent, seizing the bread. And the surgeons knew. But most of these tales ended with the satisfied declaration that the surgeon had not lived long enough to realize his profit, especially if he were bound for Batavia, where the life of a white man was brief. Only the occasional European survived the fetid atmosphere of that port.
Then, too, they spent much time doctoring the sick, often coming down with the same malady they attempted to cure in another.
And so the conversation straggled away from cargoes to the dangers of the East. 13. Garden of Delightful Confusion. Captain Verdvinen explained China's intricate system of trade to Duquet. All the ship's provisions had to be purchased from licensed provisioners, and everything was licensed.
Ship captains have to deal with licensed Chinese merchants, with licensed translators. We must pay more than 60 separate fees, endure cargo inspections to trade here. Moreover, all foreigners must stay in the special factory quarter and may not enter the city.
As they arrived in Guangzhou, Duquet stood on the deck, gazing at the long, long row of warehouses and storerooms that made up the foreign traders' quarter. The flags of different trading countries flying from them looked like a city. He stepped ashore into the novelty and noisy bustle of China. They settled into the assigned buildings that housed other Dutch traders. Captain Verdvinen reverted to his established regimen, including Duquet in it. In the morning, he made a pot of coffee, roasting the beans in a pan, grinding them in a handmill, casting the grains into boiling water, counting to 50, and allowing all to settle. The captain had another vice as well, picked up in the coffee houses of Amsterdam. He took in smoke from a pipe. That, too, had its ritual. He took out the roll of leather wherein he secreted his tobacco leaves. He chose a likely leaf, then cut it fine and finer. He filled the pipe. He lit a paper spill at the fireplace and sucked in a quantity of smoke, exhaled slowly through pursed lips with a sound like the east wind. At last, he was ready for the day's trading, and carrying two heavy satchels, he led Duquet to Wu Kwa, his Hong merchant contact. Wu Kwa was a richly dressed man with a complexion like fresh butter and a black arabesque mustache. The official translator sat between Captain Verdvinen and Wu Kwa. Duquet watched the two men bargain, the interpreter going back and forth fluidly, first Mandarin, then Dutch. Captain Verdvinen wanted special kinds of tea and silks in diverse colors and porcelain painted with garden scenes. He wanted lacquer boxes. He wanted unusual plants, not too demanding of care, as the return voyage was long. Wu Kwa suggested teas from a bewildering number of remote locations, teas in ropes, boxes, cakes. He named amounts and tempting prices. Captain Verdvinen flung up his hands and reared back in his chair as though shot. Panting, his hand over his heart, he protested the ghastly prices. He opened one of the heavy bags. Bars of silver gleamed in the darkness of the valise. He countered with an offer. Now it was Wu Kwa's turn to become pale and wave his ivory fan. He mentioned another set of figures, the same prices, but greater amounts of lesser qualities of tea, fewer colors of silks, more modestly painted ceramics, and quite ordinary plants. They were at loggerheads. Both men sat stiff and unyielding. After a long silence, Wu Kwa suggested they go into the garden. The Garden of Delightful Confusion pulled something inside Duquet as a child pulls a toy with a string. He had not known such places existed. They walked slowly along a mosaic path of tiny pebbles arranged in the pattern Wu Kwa said was plum blossoms on cracked ice. At every turn, there were rare views of flowering shrubs, moon gates. The cloud-piercing tower appeared, then the coarse lacework of Lake Tai rocks in the shape of a mountain. From its highest crag fell a waterfall no wider than 3 fingers, wrinkling the pool below. On the way to a pavilion called Painted Boat in Spring Snow, they passed between peach tree rows. At the terminus stood black stones like shrouded figures. It was a merchant's garden, and masses of peonies symbolizing wealth, delicate pink with carmine centers, grew in it. Touquet stood on an arched bridge, gazing at water flowing over pebbles.
Many times in New France have I seen water sliding over stones, but never considered it especially notable. But this is different.
Wu Kua bowed.
It is assuredly different. In your forest, clear streams occur commonly. In a city garden, they are precious. I wish you to see the 2 twisted junipers, undoubtedly rooted in the beginning of the world, that are the secret of this garden. They are hidden from casual view.
They followed him along the perimeter paths before crossing a bridge fashioned from a single massive stone. As Duquet looked up from the slightly perilous placement of his foot, the ancient junipers appeared, deformed by centuries of snow burden.
You see, said Wu Kua, that in addition to rock, water, and plant, this garden of reflection and harmony embodies the invisible element of time.
He was surprised that this coarse foreigner took pleasure from the garden. He recognized that Duquet was certainly no aesthete, but emanated that irresistible power found in men of strong wills or great wealth. Duquet did not quite see the garden as itself. In his mind, he regarded it as though he were suspended some distance above and looking down at himself walking along the mosaic paths. His presence in such a curious place made it notable to him, and it stirred him with an indefinable sensation. At the edge of a lake, they entered a pavilion. A servant brought tea. White flowers seeped a musky perfume. The pale, liquid beauty of the garden calmed the negotiators. Duquet watched the way the others held their translucent bowls, inhaled the aroma, sipped, sighed, sipped again. He did the same. At last, Wu Kua and Captain Verdwijnen rose, bowed to each other, bowed to the translator and Duquet, and they all returned to the business room. The negotiators were gentle with each other now, and each man's offer was presented as a gift, but refused by the other with flowery, elaborate speeches that seemed acceptances. Duquet watched everything intently, memorizing the procedure. Duquet felt he was in a fantastical world, but it was his skill to adapt to strange circumstances, and even to find pleasure in them. As the day drew on, the warm air thickened. At last, Wu Kua stood up, spoke rapidly to the translator, and left the room. Captain Verdwijnen said they all, even the translator, had been invited to a banquet that evening at one of the merchant's private residences. Back at their rooms, Duquet and Captain Verdwijnen washed and changed. They had an hour to wait before Wu Kua's servants came for them. Duquet got out the gin.
Did you work out a fair price for the goods you want? He asked the captain.
Not yet, not yet. We have only begun. We shall continue tomorrow, and perhaps the next day, and the next. Haste is not advisable. Slow, contemplative weighing of loss and gain, of prestige, of honor, and much more are involved.
Duquet envied this captain who so skillfully played the cards. Captain Verdwijnen lit his long clay pipe and puffed out smoke.
You are wondering when we will get to your furs, no?
His foot waggled.
Yes, said Duquet.
I do wonder.
Eventually. There is no hurry. In any case, we cannot leave until we finish conducting our business.
next year with the correct wind for our return. So, enjoy your time here.
What did you think of the garden?
Why, very, very agreeable.
I also like beautiful gardens.